Deuteronomy chapter 1, if you would please. Deuteronomy chapter 1 will cover about 40 years of Moses' life. This morning, the 40 years of Moses in the wilderness. We're giving you the, in my opinion, the 50 best stories in the Bible. And the thought occurred to me, I've been kind of, you know, leaving. I've left out some really good stories. And the thought occurred to me, what if I finish with 42 stories? And I'm all the way at Revelation. Well, then I'll have the privilege of going back and picking my 8 favorites to add them to the bunch. We'll insert them in. But what I'm trying to do is give you, I think, the 50 best stories in the Bible. But the discriminating factor is these stories have to involve the flow of Scripture and the story of Scripture, which is tracing the line of the Redeemer, God's plan to redeem mankind from sin. And so beginning with Adam all the way to the end, that's kind of the discriminating factor. This is story number 11, and we've titled this Moses, the Servant of God. Now, we've preached about Moses, the Deliverer, and how he delivered Israel from Egyptian bondage. Last Sunday, we preached about Moses, the Lawgiver, and how he delivered God's law to Israel on Mount Sinai. Today, we preach about Moses, the Servant, how he led Israel during the wilderness wanderings for 40 years until coming to the land of Canaan. In this, we see as a servant, he was on one side the prophet of God and on the other side the mediator of Israel. There was more than one occasion where Moses literally stood between the dead and the living, Numbers 16:48, literally. He was the mediator, and there was more than one time that God said, why don't I just consume this whole ungrateful nation? I'll just consume them all, and I'll start all over again with you. And Moses said, please, Lord, don't do that. More than one time, he was the mediator, he was the intercessor. As we look at Deuteronomy chapter 1, I give you this. The setting is the east side of the Jordan River. A lot of people don't realize it, but going from Egypt to Israel, the easiest way would to have been entered on the west side of Israel. But as it turned out, by the time they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, they actually came in on the opposite side, on the east side of Israel, and they had to cross Jordan. So they're on the east side of the Jordan River in the land of Gilead, and they're camped out there. The time is at the end of Moses' career in life, just before yielding leadership to Joshua, and the occasion for the book of Deuteronomy is the repetition of the law of God. Now, we're not going to repeat the law, we're not going to get into that, but with the repetition of the law of God, he gives a review and a summary of their history since their deliverance from Egypt. And that's basically what this story today is about, is the wilderness wanderings. And boy, I could preach 12 or 15 messages just on the wilderness wanderings if we got really down to the brass tacks and nails of each one of the events that occurred. We could actually take weeks to preach through just the wilderness wanderings. But I want you to begin with me in Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 1. These be the words which Moses spake unto all Israel on this side Jordan in the wilderness, in the plain, over against the Red Sea between Paran and Tophel and Laban and Haziroth and Dizahab. There are, and this is an important thing to notice, there are 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir unto Kadesh Barnea. And it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spake unto the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment unto them. After he had slain Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt in Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, which dwelt at Astaroth and Edrea, on this side Jordan, in the land of Moab, began Moses to declare this law, saying, so now Moses is speaking, the Lord our God spake unto us in Horeb. Now, Horeb is another name for Sinai. So he's talking here about Sinai. This is what the Lord said, saying, ye have dwelt long enough in this mount. Turn you and take your journey and go to the mount of the Amorites and to all the places nigh thereunto, in the plain and the hills and the vale and the south and by the seaside to the land of the Canaanites and into Lebanon unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Verse 8, behold, I have set the land before you. What land? The land that the Lord sware unto your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, let me give you a couple of things here before we go on. We're in verses 1 through 8 now. In verse 2, I want you to catch this. There's only 11 days' journey from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea was the staging ground for the 12 spies. Now, I don't have a map in front of you, so I'm going to try to do this in such a way that you can grasp this and understand what's taking place. Let's say the area behind the pulpit here is the nation of, or the land of Canaan, the land of Palestine, the promised land. We would call it Israel today. It's the land where God has promised Abraham and Isaac and Jacob to dwell. Well, they're down here. If you go east and south, they were had been in Egypt. They cross the Red Sea. They go down to Horeb, which is about this place, Mount Sinai. They received the law. They spent about 2 years there. And then they marched up to Kadesh Barnea. Now, it would have made sense. It was 11 days' journey to get to Kadesh Barnea, which was the border of the Promised Land. But you remember, they didn't go in. They sent in 12 spies. The 12 spies came back and had a business meeting, voted 10-2. And 10 being the majority, won. And they discouraged the heart of the brethren. And the Lord said, okay, you were in the land. The spies were in the land for 40 days. So you're going to wander 1 year in the wilderness for each day that the spies spent in the Promised Land. And so they turned away. And so they spent the next 40 years wandering around in circles. There are 45 campsites listed. Now, often they would camp in one place for a year. And you can follow that. Numbers chapter 33 is where you'll find that information. But they wandered around in circles. And remember how the Lord led them? The Lord led them with a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. And when the pillar of cloud hovered over the tabernacle, it meant we're not moving today. We're staying right here. And when the Lord was ready to move them, the cloud would ascend and it would move in the direction they were supposed to go and the whole camp would move. Well, now what has happened is they have wandered through all of this wilderness and they've wandered around now to the entire opposite side of the Promised Land so that they're actually coming in now from the east, not the west. Now that was 11 days' journey if they would have been faithful and gone right on in. It takes some real intelligent people to turn an 11-day journey into a 40-year odyssey. Don't you think? But that's what they did. And so now they're on the other side of the Jordan River, and they're going to have to cross the Jordan River. They could have marched right in. They were there. I mean, they were what we'd call knocking on the door. They were there. What do we learn from that? Unbelief, which many people believe is the seed of disobedience. If you study theologians usually say, well, the root of sin is, some say the root of sin is unbelief. Some say the root of sin is pride. And some say the root of sin is selfishness. But all sin is caused by one of those three root events. I'm not sure which one I believe. I can kind of see all of them. There's a little pride and a little selfishness and maybe a little unbelief in all of us. How many would have to nod your head and say, yeah, I could agree with that. There's a little of that in me. But unbelief and disobedience, unbelief begets disobedience. Pride begets disobedience. Selfishness begets disobedience. And the result is an 11-day journey turns into a 40-year escapade. And so let us learn a lesson there that lots of times we lose faith, lack faith, and we fail to take a step of faith. And as a result of that, what we could have done in 11 days, we spend 40 years doing. I know that's a hyperbole, but you understand what I'm saying. We can make life tough on ourselves because we simply didn't do what God said to do. And we end up paying for it for many, many years because we just wouldn't go in. And so then in verses 6 and 7, which we just read, the Lord speaks and he says, "Ye have dwelt long enough in this mount. Turn you and take your journey." Now, I see, reading between the lines there, I see that the people of Israel had become a little bit comfortable there at the foot of Mount Sinai. I mean, there was safety there, there was security there, the Mount of God was there, God spoke his law to us there, we had some good times there, and so forth and so on, and they were a little lackadaisical about leaving, and the Lord had to say to them, "You've dwelt long enough here, you need to be moving on." And so, can I say this to you? Comfort zones are traps. Comfort zones are traps. Growth means change, and change means movement, forward movement. But can I tell you, nobody ever stays the same. You think, "Well, I'll just stay right here. I'll stay the same." No, nobody's static. You're either moving forward or you're declining. You're going backwards. So you need to decide, I'm going to grow for the Lord, and that means I'm going to have to change, and that means I'm going to have to move. I've heard preachers brag and say, "Bless God, I haven't changed in 40 years. Well, that should be an embarrassing thing to say. What you just said is, "I haven't grown in 40 years. Listen, if you grow, you're going to change. Hopefully for the better. Sometimes growth is not a good thing, but most of the time growth is a good thing. But growth requires movement, and movement requires change. So we see that. And then God gave them the land. Notice in verse 8, he says, "Behold, I have set the land before you." Now the Hebrew meaning behind that word, "I have set the land before you," means it is yours, lock, stock, and barrel, title deed. I have given it to you. All you have to do is go possess it. And so these people didn't have to do anything to get the land. It was all the doing was done. In God's mind, God was going to fight for them. God was going to lead them. He had given them the land. They didn't have to buy it. They didn't have to pay for it. They didn't have to fight. Oh, yeah, they were going to fight, but the Lord was the one who was going to do the fighting. And so it's an important thing to understand that the Lord was giving them exactly what he had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now read with me verse 9. "And I spake unto you at that time," this is Moses speaking, "I spake unto you at that time, I'm not able to bear you myself alone." Moses is confessing here to his inability. And most leadership conferences would say, man, don't ever confess to an inability. Don't ever confess to a weakness, which is, I think, a fault in leadership. I think there's nothing wrong in leadership with confessing a fault. My pastor taught me years ago, he said, always remind the people that you have clay feet. Just don't let them see them. You understand? There's no fault in saying, "Listen, I'm unable. I'm weak. I'm frail. I have to depend upon the Lord." You just don't want to look weak in front of the people. You need to take your stand and stand up. But we see Moses here expressing his inability to rule the people alone. Notice what he said in verse 12. He said, "How can I myself alone bear your cumbrance and your burden?" And here's the killer, "and your strife." Now, I want you to understand what made it difficult for Moses wasn't just the multitude, although it is a difficult thing for one man to lead 2.5 million people. I've always had a way of, in my mind, trying to think of a way to say this. When I think of 2.5 million people, it's hard for me to comprehend that when I live in the town of Wayland. But I lived in West St. Louis County for 11 years. And in East and West St. Louis metropolitan area, there are 2.5 million people. That's how many Jews there were. Now, you think of the logistics of getting 2.5 million people across the Red Sea. Think of the logistics of striking the rock because there's no water for 2.5 million people, and you strike the rock and expect... I remember when I was a kid seeing a Sunday school lesson where there was a Moses struck the rock and there was a little stream of water about that big around that came out of the rock. All that would have done was create a panic. Don't kid yourself, when Moses struck that rock, logistically speaking, there had to have been a river come out of that rock in order to satisfy the water needs of 2.5 million people, plus their livestock. So think about moving the city of St. Louis, the metropolitan area of St. Louis, through the desert day after day. Think about the problem of sanitation. Think about the problem of food and water. You know, listen, my wife and I can fill up in our kitchen garbage can. I don't know how we do this. I don't know how two old people go through so much trash. We fill up one of those 13-gallon cans at least once a day, sometimes twice. I can't believe how much trash we make. And we're just two old people. If we had 5 or 6 kids, we'd be dumping and burning trash all day long. I can't believe how much trash we go through. Think about the people in the desert. What did they do with all their trash? What did they do with all their sanitation needs? And Moses is responsible for all of this. Okay, now here's the real killer. The multitude creates part of the problem, but the attitude of the multitude is the worst problem of all. These are not happy people. They're not people that are easy to get along with. They're not people that like each other, let alone Moses and Aaron. Half of the people want to go back to Egypt. It is a real problem. And Moses said, I told the Lord, I can't bear you all by myself. And so Moses complained to the Lord. And so what happened? Moses took the advice of his father-in-law back in Exodus chapter 18. And you'll see here what was said. Look in verse 13. Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And ye answered me and said, the thing which thou hast spoken is good for us to do. So I took the chief of your tribes, wise men and known, and made them heads over your captains, over thousands, and captains over thousands, captains over hundreds, captains over fifties, and captains over tens, and officers among your tribes. And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes which your brethren hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of men, for the judgment is God's. In the cause that is too hard for you, bring it to me and I will hear it. Now what I want you to get here is that is not only how the people of Israel were governed from that day forward, but our founding fathers in the United States of America read Exodus chapter 18. And they read Deuteronomy chapter 21. And they said, that's a very wise system of government. They read Isaiah 33:22, where Isaiah said, the Lord is our king, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our judge. They read those passages and said, you know, there's things to be learned here. From Deuteronomy chapter 1, we see a representative form of government. Our founding fathers saw that. By the way, you call that a republic, not a democracy. This country is so wrongly called a democracy. It is not a democracy. It is a republic, meaning that we have representative government. And there were qualifications for those representatives. Those representatives were, by the way, they became known as leaders. That's leadership. There's qualifications for leadership. They were to have righteous, impartial judgment, but it was a constitutional form of government based on, according to Exodus 18, commandments, statutes, and judgments. Do you know these people were not ruled by men? They were really not ruled by Moses. They were ruled by laws of God. Our founding father said, we are sick to death of kings. We're tired of King George III. We're tired of King Henry VIII. We're tired of the King of France. We're tired of the King of whatever it is. We're tired of kings. They get up one morning and they're in a bad mood, so they cut off all of the blue-eyed people's heads. They get up another day and they're in a bad mood and they cut off all of the red-haired people's heads. They get up another day and they give everybody a raise. Nobody can tell what they're going to do. Listen, kings are fickle. They said, we want to be a people governed by laws. Laws that are not easily changed. Laws that are made with thought and forethought and prayer. And we want to be a people governed by those laws that are thoughtfully made and not easily changed. Our founding fathers looked at Isaiah 33:22 and saw a government that had three branches. And they saw in that a balance of power, the executive branch, the Lord is our king. The Lord is our lawgiver. They saw the legislative branch. The Lord is our judge. They saw the judicial branch. And so they drew up our Constitution based on what they saw in the Word of God. So we have what we call an American Christian form of government. It's a constitutional form of government. It is a representative form of government. Notice there was a system of appeal. Moses said, the cause that's too hard for you, bring it to me. So I just want you to understand that this is a really important passage in that our American founding fathers looked into this and saw the basic tenets of our own American system of government. Then if you look at verse 19, the Lord speaks, or Moses speaks, and he says, and when we departed from Horeb, we went through all that great and terrible wilderness which ye saw by the way of the mountain of the Amorites as the Lord our God commanded us, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. And then he begins to reiterate and rehearse what took place at Kadesh Barnea. They sent in the 12 spies. They came to Kadesh Barnea. Matter of fact, they got there in 11 days. The first time they went to Kadesh Barnea, 11-day journey. It was an 11-day journey. And they arrived. And they came and they sent in the 12 spies. Notice verse 22. Ye came near unto me, every one of you, and said, we will send men before us. And they shall search us out the land and bring us word again by what way we must go up and into what cities. And the saying pleased me. And I took 12 men of you, one of a tribe. So all 12 tribes had a representative. There you have the representative form of government again. And they sent the spies in. And Moses goes ahead and he rehearses and reiterates this. But in the long run, it didn't do any good. Can I tell you this? They wanted to send in the spies. And there's nothing wrong with counting the cost. As a matter of fact, Jesus told us that disciples should count the cost. But let me say this. Counting the cost does not justify disobedience before God. When God commands us to move, you say, well, look, I went and looked, and there's big walled cities and big tall giants, big dudes, and I'm not going in there. That's just disobedience. The old saying is, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And especially when the Lord shall fight for you. So the spies went in. They brought back an evil report. They said, the land is good, but the people are giants. We cannot win. 10 spies said that. Moses encouraged them. Verse 29. Moses encouraged them. He said, the Lord your God goeth before you. This is verse 30. Verse 29 says, then said I unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God, which goeth before you, he shall fight for you according to all that he did before your eyes in Egypt, or before you in Egypt, before your eyes. Now, what did he do in Egypt? Well, he pretty well wiped Egypt out. Listen, the Lord doesn't have to have soldiers to win. He can send in frogs. He can send in flies. He can send in lice. These are the things that make him the Lord of hosts. When the Bible talks about him being the Lord of hosts, that means God commands all different kinds of hosts. He commands frogs. He can bring frogs up and take over a whole town. He can bring in locusts that eat every green thing that is in sight. In the case of taking the promised land later, when Moses has died and Joshua's in charge, you'll find out that the Lord makes up an army of hornets. And those, you try, I don't care if you are 8'4" tall or 9'5" tall, you try fighting the Israelites with hornets in your helmet. The best of soldiers will go nuts. You ever have a hornet try to get in your ear? Ever have a hornet? I remember one morning, I'd fished all night. This was years ago. I'd fished all night. A couple of my boys and I had fished all night. And we'd outlived the mosquitoes the night before. Actually, that's not a hard thing. You push the boat off the shore, you go out in the middle of the lake, the mosquitoes aren't out there. They all linger around the trees. You could literally hear the mosquitoes humming in the trees, but they weren't bothering us. So we fished all night. But about 4 o'clock in the morning, the gnats came out. I'm telling you, there were gnats crawling in my ears, gnats crawling up my nose, gnats trying to get in my eyes, gnats trying to get in my mouth. And I said, we got to get out of here. We couldn't pull up our trot line and get out of there fast enough. Those gnats were about to eat us alive. And yet they weren't eating anything. They were just driving us nuts. But hornets sting. God made an army of hornets. He didn't need Israel to fight. He could fight for himself. And so Moses is making this point. But unbelief ruled. Moses encouraged, verse 32, yet in this thing ye did not believe the Lord, who went in the way before you to search you out a place to pitch your tents in fire by night, to show you by what way ye should go in the cloud by day. I mean, God has led you and led you and led you. A cloud by day, a fire by night, and yet you would not do this thing. Why? Because you didn't believe the Lord. And the Lord heard the voice of your words and was wroth and swore, saying, surely there's not one of these men of this evil generation that shall see that good land which I swear to give unto your fathers. Now, Caleb, he'll see it. Joshua, he'll see it. Those two guys voted yes, but everybody else who voted no, everybody of this generation, and it turned out to be everybody who was 20 years old or older, will die in the next 40 years in the wilderness. So we see that Joshua and Caleb argued with the people. Unbelief still ruled. The spies discouraged the heart of the people. And the people then, because of the spies' evil report, the people rebelled and murmured. Can I say this? It's an evil thing to destroy the faith of others. Did you hear that? It is an evil thing to destroy the faith of others. I would not want to be any of those 10 men on Judgment Day. Because not only did they sin themselves, but they caused 2.5 million people to sin by saying no to God. When you destroy the faith of others, it's just a terrible thing. It leads to rebellion and murmuring. By the way, rebellion and murmuring are related to each other. So God's sentence was rendered in verse 40. Not one of those men will see the land. Now, then the people, they had remorse and they recanted. Look in verse 41. Then they answered and said, this is kind of childish of them. This is what kids do when they find out, oh, I'm going to get spanked for that. Okay, well, then I'll go ahead and do it. I'm going to be spanked for that. Okay, I changed my mind. I'll do it. That's too late now. There was a moment you could have obeyed gladly. But now you've disobeyed. You're going to get spanked. Well, these people, look in verse 41. We have sinned against the Lord. We will go up and fight according to all that the Lord our God commanded us. And when ye had girded on every man his weapons of war, ye were ready to go up into the hill. And the Lord said unto me, say unto them, go not up to fight, for I am not among you, lest ye be smitten by your enemies. you'd better never make a journey where the Lord is not among you. The most important thing on any journey is to know that He's among us. When Nathan was here for the revival 3 weeks ago, we got in the car with his kids to go somewhere. And I backed the car, put the car in reverse and backed up. And they said, "Are we not going to pray?" And I said, "Do you guys pray on every journey?" They said, "Oh, yeah, every time we go somewhere, we pray." I said, "Well, okay." We put the car in park and we had a prayer. And we asked the Lord to give us safety on the road. And I pulled the car back and drive and we drove away. You better not ever make a journey without the Lord. Understand, these people learned that the hard way. If as you remember, they went presumptuously up the hill. Look at verse 43. "So I spake unto you, and ye would not hear, but rebelled against the commandment of the Lord, and went presumptuously up into the hill. And the Amorites, which dwelt in the mountain, came out against you, and chased you as bees do, and destroyed you in Seir, even unto Horeb. And you returned and wept before the Lord, but the Lord would not hearken to your voice, nor give ear unto you." Boy, I'm telling you, presumption is the same thing as pride. It is the attitude, "I can do this by myself. I don't need anybody's help. I don't need God's help. I can do this alone." And can I tell you then, secondarily, presumption closes the ears of God. When a person has been presumptuous with the Lord, he just doesn't hear their prayer. Then we come to chapter 2 and verse 1. And this is an amazing verse because of all that it covers. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. "Then we turned and took our journey into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spake unto me, and we compassed Mount Seir many days." And the next thing you know, verses 2 and 3, "And the Lord spake unto me, saying, ye have compassed this mountain long enough, turn you northward." Now that's 40 years later. 40 years have transpired, and all the events that took place in the wilderness transpire in verse 1. Now, you say, "Well, how do I know what happened in verse 1? We have to go back to the book of Numbers and start in chapter 13. And so I've done that for you. I'm going to give it to you quickly. All of the events of 40 years, which includes Numbers 13 all the way through Numbers 36, the wilderness wanderings are all included here. The Kadesh Barnea affair, which we've already talked about. By the way, in the Kadesh Barnea affair, I didn't tell you this, but during all of the confrontation between Moses and the 12 spies and the congregation of the people of Israel, God appeared in glory. And God said, in that event, "Let me just destroy them. I'll just kill them all. I'll consume them and start over with you." And Moses said, "Please don't do that." So God appeared in glory and Moses interceded. That's part of Moses' job as a mediator, is to intercede for God's people. And so Numbers 13 through 15 tell the story of the Kadesh Barnea affair. Three full chapters are dedicated to that. Then you come to chapter 16 and you see the Korah affair. And that's where Korah came and challenged Moses for leadership. He said, "Do you think you're the only one God can use? You and Aaron? God can use us too." By the way, Korah was Moses' cousin. And Korah wanted in on the leadership. He thought he was missing out. He wanted to lead the people. And so when it was all said and done, the glory of God appeared again. After he challenged Moses for leadership, God's glory appeared and Moses spoke to the people and he said, "Okay, I'm going to prove to you that I am ordained by God to do what I'm doing. If these people die in an ordinary way, then I'm not called of God. But if the earth opens up and swallows them," Korah and his friends, "if the earth opens up and swallows them, then you'll know I'm of God." And guess what? Next morning, the earth opened up and swallowed them. 250 of them were out there burning incense with censers, and that was a job that only the family of the priests were allowed to do. That was descendants of Aaron. They were the only ones who could burn incense. And And so fire came down from heaven and destroyed that 250 people. Then the congregation murmured. God's glory appeared again. The Lord was moved again to consume them. And he sent a plague this time. 14,700 died in the plague until Aaron went out and made a sacrifice of atonement and stopped it. And that's one of the places where the Bible said literally that Moses and Aaron stood between the dead and the living. Then we had Aaron's rod affair, Numbers chapter 17. Again, this time not Moses' authority, but Aaron's authority was being questioned. Somebody came and said, we think that Aaron shouldn't be the only one. And so the Lord spoke to Moses again, and he said, listen, take a rod from each tribe. Take Aaron's rod and another rod from each tribe and put them all together, and I'm going to show you something. And Aaron's rod, which is really a dead stick with no roots and no life, Aaron's rod bloomed and blossomed and bore almonds. And God said, I'm showing you that Aaron is the one who has authority from God. Don't anyone else question it again. Then you saw Miriam died in the wilderness of Zin. And then in Numbers chapter 20, it was the rock at Meribah, or the waters of Meribah, where the people chided Moses because they were out of water. And they said, we're out of water. What are you trying to make us die in the wilderness? We're out of water again. And so the Lord spoke to Moses. As a matter of fact, the glory of God appeared again to Moses. And he said, there's a rock. Speak to it this time. Speak to it. Well, Moses, in his anger and in his unbelief, struck the rock not once but twice with his rod in disobedience to God. You have to understand that rock was a type of Christ. Christ was stricken the first time when he was crucified. He never needs to be crucified again. He never needs to be stricken again. From now on, after Jesus died on the cross and paid for our sins, all we have to do is pray to him. We speak to him. And Moses was to speak to this rock, but he didn't. He struck it again, and he struck it twice. And though God gave the people water, that mistake cost Moses his trip into the promised land. You remember that. We'll come back to it again later. And so the Rock of Meribah incident, where Israel strove with God over the water. And then in Numbers 20, Aaron died. And then in Numbers 21, there was the fiery serpent affair. The people were in a really difficult journey. The way was hard. The rocks were big. There was not enough water. There was not enough of a lot of things, and they were struggling. It was difficult, and they began to complain, and they began to murmur. And the Bible said they didn't just murmur at Moses and Aaron, they murmured against the Lord. And the Lord sent fiery serpents. We would assume that would be poisonous, venomous, fanged snakes. And those snakes went in their midst and began to bite them. An untold number perished. Guess what? Moses interceded for the people again. Lord, please, please stop this. The people cried out to Moses, we've sinned. We shouldn't have complained against the Lord. And Moses interceded for them. And the Lord said, make a brass serpent and put it on a pole and hold it high up in the air. And everyone who looks upon that serpent shall live. And that was a picture again of the Lord Jesus Christ. John chapter 3, Jesus speaking to Nicodemus cited that and said, the way the people looked at that serpent in the wilderness, if they'll look at me that same way, they shall be saved from their sins. And so there was the fiery serpent affair. Then there was the Balaam affair. How many remember where Balak, the king of Moab, went out and he hired Balaam and he said, I want you to come out and stand on a mountain and I want you to look down upon Israel. I want you to curse them. And he said, well, I got to tell you, I can only curse who God curses, and I can only bless who God blesses. And so he came out on the mountain, and he stood on the mountain, looked down at Israel as they went along. And when he went to speak, guess what? He couldn't find a curse of any kind. All that would come was a blessing. And he blessed him, and it made Balak so mad. He tried three times to curse him. Never could curse him. But finally, Balaam told Balak, the king of Moab, he said, But I tell you, if you really want to destroy them, God himself will destroy them if you'll just send some of your women down into the camp and commit immorality with their men. God will destroy them himself. And that's exactly what happened, the Balaam affair. 24,000 people died in the plague when those people committed immorality with the Moabitish women. Finally, Phinehas stopped it when he ran in a tent and took a javelin and ran through a couple that were committing immorality, and that plague was stopped. I want to tell you, Israel was numbered in the plains. Numbers chapter 26. Their journeys were documented camp by camp. Numbers chapter 33. 45 different sites they had where they camped. Now, we've kind of given you verse 1. It was a lot easier and quicker to read verse 1 than it was to preach all of Numbers from 14 through 36. But now we come to verse 2. And the Lord spake unto me, saying, ye have compassed this mountain long enough, turn you northward. He's saying, okay, it's time for you to go into the promised land. 40 years are up. It's time to go in. Command thou the people, saying, you're to pass through the coast of your of the brethren, the children of Esau, which dwell in Seir. They shall be afraid of you. Take you good heed unto yourselves. Look at verse 5. Meddle not with them. Now, it's kind of interesting, as they're preparing to go toward the promised land now, they have to go past the Edomites, but they're told, don't mess with them. Okay, that's what the Hebrew word means. Don't mess with them. Don't meddle with them. And then in verse 9, the Lord said unto me, distress not the Moabites. Don't contend with them. Don't mess with them. Why? Because they're the children of Lot. See, the Edomites are the children of Esau. The Moabites are the children of Lot. Look at verse 19, chapter 2, verse 19. When thou comest over against the children of Ammon, distress them not, nor meddle with them. Why? They're the children also of Lot. Remember, Lot had two sons. By incest, but two sons, just the same, Moab and Ammon. And so all of the Moabites are descendants of Lot, who was the nephew of Abraham. They're kin. Distant, but they're kin. What's the point here? The Lord forbade confrontation with relation, no matter how far removed. These people are kin. So don't mess with the Edomites, the Moabites, or the Ammonites. But in chapter 2, verse 24... they come to Sihon the Amorite. Rise ye up, take your journey, pass over the river Arnon. Behold, I have given into thy hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to possess it and contend with him in battle. This day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, who shall hear report of thee and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee. Remember a few months later, when the spies go into Jericho, Rahab the harlot said to them, our hearts have heard about you. We've heard about you, and our hearts have melted within our chests with fear. This is exactly what the Lord said he was going to do. Verse 30, but Sihon, king of Heshbon, would not let us pass by him, for the Lord thy God hardened his spirit, made his heart obstinate, that he might deliver him into thy hand, as appeareth this day. Look at chapter 3, verse 1. Then we turned and went up the way of Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us and all his people to battle at Edrei. And the Lord said to me, fear him not, and so forth. I will deliver him into your hands. So the Lord gave them the land of Sihon and Og. Then we come to chapter 3 and verse 21. And I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, thine eyes have seen all that the Lord your God hath done. I'm going to have to hurry here, aren't I? Thine eyes have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto these two kings. So shall the Lord do unto all the kingdom whither thou passest. Ye shall not fear them. For the Lord your God, he shall fight for you. And I besought the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness and thy mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or earth that can do according to thy works and according to thy prayer? I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain in Lebanon. Now look at verse 26. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, let it suffice thee, speak no more of this matter. The Lord did let Moses go up into Mount Pisgah. And in Mount Pisgah he overlooked the promised land from the east side of Jordan, but he was not permitted to set one foot in the promised land because of the incident at the waters of Meribah. Striking the rock twice when he should have spoken to it cost Moses entering the promised land. Notice this, verse 28, but charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before the people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which thou shalt see. I'm going to have to tie this up a little quicker than I had planned, but I want you to see this. The people vexed the Lord repeatedly, and yet they were permitted to enter. Now, remember, the first generation all died in the wilderness, but the guys that were under 20 who grew up in the wilderness and who had stayed with the Lord all this time, even though they had murmured and complained just like their dads and moms had, they were still allowed to go in. But Moses messes up one time and he doesn't get to go in. That's always struck me funny. Numbers 14:22 says, because all those men which have seen my glory, this is the Lord speaking, all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in wilderness, have tempted me now these 10 times and have not hearkened to my voice. The Lord was aware that the people of Israel were not an obedient people. Whether it was the first generation out of Egypt or the second generation out of Egypt, they were not godly people. And yet the Lord let them go in. But Moses sinned this one time. This one time he fails by striking the rock twice instead of speaking to it. And God says, okay, that's it for you. I don't know about you, but I've always struggled a little bit with that. It doesn't seem to me like that's quite just until you think of it this way. Moses had been on the mountain twice. Each time 40 days and 40 nights. Moses had seen God's glory repeatedly. Moses had been on the mountain, the presence of the Lord, in such a way that his face glowed when he came off the mountain. The Shekinah glory of God had actually transferred itself to Moses' face, and his face was shining like God's glory when he came off the mountain. Moses had seen things the other people hadn't seen. They'd seen a lot. Many of them had seen the Red Sea divided. They'd seen the 10 plagues in Egypt. They'd seen God bring water out of the rock twice. They'd seen God give manna every day for 40 years. They'd seen God do some miraculous things, but they still hadn't seen what Moses had seen. Is it just of God to expect more from Moses than the rest of the people? What do you think? Well, I think of this principle that Jesus gave in Luke chapter 12, verse 48, and this will be our closing point. Jesus said, for unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required. Let me read that again. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required. And to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. The only way that I can see this working is that God looked upon Moses and said, Moses, you've seen things other people haven't seen. You've been places other people haven't been. You've been up on the mountain. I trusted you to bring you into my presence. I put you in the cleft of the rock, and I put my hand over your eyes until my glory passed by, and then I took my hand off and you saw my backside. But none of the other people saw what you've seen. And because of that, I expect more from you. I ask you, we've been given so much as God's people. How much shall be required of us at the judgment seat? We live in a free country. We do not have to show our passport to cross into Iowa. It's an amazing thing, but we don't. We can go to Illinois. We can cross the Mississippi River, and we don't have to stop at a checkpoint and show ID. This is a free country. You say, well, patriots died to make it that way. It would have never been that way without the Lord's blessing. There's not enough blood in all the patriots that have ever lived to make a country free without the hand of God. We have a free country because God gave us a free country. Every day you get in your car and drive down the highway, you should say, blessed be God. What a blessed person I am. We get up. I say this morning, everyone in this room had breakfast unless you chose not to. Very few of us, if any of us, lack the provision for this day. I have enough money to pay my bills. I have clothes on my back, food in my belly, a house over my head. I have a wife who loves me. I have children that I thank the Lord for. I have 28 or 29 or 30 grandkids. I've lost track. Ask my wife. She knows. But I'm telling you, God has been good to me. And to whom much is given, much shall be required. When we stand at the judgment seat of Christ, we could understand the song, I'll wish I had given him more. I'll wish I had given him more. That'll be our song one day. To whom much is given, much is required. What do you owe? Would you bow your heads in prayer, please?